This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Etopia Medical News Network. We're about to talk to Karen Barth Menzies, who's an attorney with Baum Hedlund here in Los Angeles, about a number of cases and reports and maybe cover-ups that are affecting the landscape of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Welcome to Etopia Medical News Network.
Thank you.
In a sense, this interview may be a microcosm of this Paxil addiction case that you're working on, because there's so much material, and we're going to have a question about that as well. In fact, why don't we start with that? You're running this large class action suit. What's the charge against whom, and what's the status of that case now?
The Paxil withdrawal cases or addiction cases have been consolidated into a federal district court here in Los Angeles, and we're just reorganizing the group because it's now such a large group of thousands of individuals.
How big is it? Or do you know? Do you even know exactly?
Yeah, well, right now it's about 1,500 people have filed their individual claims, and they're moving forward, but that's actually fastly growing, and I think it'll get upwards to about between 4,000 and 5,000.
Okay. Is there a deadline for when people need to sign up?
No, it's just the way the courts are trying to coordinate because so many people have been filing.
Okay. Now, there's a thing called a plaintiff steering committee?
Correct.
What is that exactly? What's your role on it, and what's it doing?
We were just appointed lead counsel on the to run the strategy and the litigation related to these cases.
So that means you're in the position then to decide who's going to actually be there in court and what kind of settlement, if any, is going to be decided upon.
Correct. It's all litigation matters, any settlement matters if they come up, all the strategy.
Okay, who else in general is on that committee besides you?
My co-counsel is Weiss and Yorman here in Los Angeles, Chris Coffin at the Penley firm in Louisiana, and Donald Farber, who's up in Marin County.
Now, am I right in thinking that all of those firms and all those people are working at this point on the expectation of being paid at the end of the case and are not charging any of these 1,500 people anything, or how does that work?
Well, it's not a class action, so we actually have individual retainers with each of our clients. There are some class action allegations pending. If those were to be certified, there would be issues of court-awarded fees. But we have individual contracts with each of our clients.
Oh, okay. In some cases are contingency, in some cases are retainer, or both, or what?
The retainers are contingency, yes.
Okay. Okay. Now, there was a recent development that decided that marked a step forward in the case that happened yesterday. What was that? A decision that appointed you lead.
Okay. Yeah, we did a press release on that, and that must be what you'd seen. It was actually on Monday that occurred.
Oh, okay. What is it that occurred exactly?
There was just a motion by counsel, different counsel seeking the leadership positions, and the court granted our motion requesting leadership. So we're now designated as the lead counsel.
Were there competing counsel asking to be made lead counsel?
Yes, they wanted to be involved in the leadership structure.
How many competitors did you have?
There was one motion filed by an attorney out here in Pasadena, and he had claimed to have a group of about seven different law firms that were interested in being involved in that leadership structure.
But the judge turned that down?
Correct.
Say something about that judge, who she is, and what her record has been so far in terms of managing this case.
It's Judge Falzer, Marianne Falzer, and she's been on the bench for quite 20 years at least or more.
Right.
She's a very good judge. She's been working on these cases for almost 3 years now, so she's extremely experienced and educated on the issues. So we look forward to continuing to work with her on the case.
Does she have a backup or an understudy in case something happens and she has to go off the case and they have to educate somebody again for a lot of this material?
Well, the federal court always assigns a magistrate to go with it, so
right.
We have a magistrate judge who herself has also been dealing with some discovery matters, so she's getting educated through this process as well. So she is her backup.
Okay. Again, differentiate between a multi-district case and a class action, and exactly what you've got going in terms of those categories.
The multi-district just simply means that there are cases filed throughout the country in various different districts and federal courts in different states, and so the judicial panel decided to consolidate all of those. We moved for it. The defendants opposed it, and the judicial panel agreed and moved all the cases to be in front of one judge.
Because they wanted to try it all over the country in multiple cases and spend more money and time and effort doing it, right?
Oh, absolutely. That it's kind of a divide and conquer mentality,
right.
Because especially since we represent so many individuals, it's a way of you know, trying to spread the plaintiff's counsel so thin that they might, you know, be able to try to effectively harm our efforts in,
right.
You know,
okay.
Litigating.
But you won on that point.
We did.
Okay, is there much of a practical difference that this isn't, strictly speaking, a class action suit?
Well, there is a procedural difference, and the really fundamental difference is simply that a class action, once it's certified, means the court permits individual plaintiff representatives to go forward on behalf of unnamed individuals.
Okay.
And so those unnamed individuals are not required to come into court with their discovery and their medical records and their information. It can be done by the plaintiffs that are there to represent everybody.
And they represent others similarly situated.
Correct.
Okay. And so in other words, you're only bringing action now against the people who are your named plaintiffs.
That's correct. There are a couple cases where we have class actions still pending on particular issues, like the consumer fraud statutes. There are some class claims that we intend to get, see if we can get those certified in different states.
Okay, but on the addiction / withdrawal cases, it's all individual clients brought together in one case.
For the personal injury compensatory damages, yes.
Okay. Now that the judge has appointed you as lead counsel, what happens next? What are the next procedural steps?
With regard to that litigation, the next step is to really kind of map out how the rest of the discovery will go. Timing, you know, it's a lot of administrative stuff and organizing. There's a lot of controversial discovery that we want to obtain, not only from GlaxoSmithKline, but also from the FDA. So we're certain we'll need to seek help from the court to resolve those issues. Those will come up in the next few months. We're also working with counsel in the U.K., who are handling the Paxil cases over there. So we'll be coordinating some discovery efforts and doing some foreign discovery of witnesses over in England.
At this point, is it possible to make an estimate about how long this is all going to take?
I think that I would say about a year and a half to 2 years might be a trial date time or time for remand.
You mean there'll be a trial starting in 1.5 to 2 years?
Well, there might be some what are called bellwether plaintiffs that go forward first, and in which case those would go forward sooner than that, I believe. But the MDL is designed to get through all the pretrial discovery, like what we're talking about, hammer out all those issues, and then remand the cases back to their original states for trial.
Oh, okay. Now this is essentially to put on the record all of the relevant research data and administrative data involving the drug and its sales administration and what they knew about it and so on.
Yes, that's what we're gathering now. Unfortunately, it won't be in the public record unless and until something's tried, but what it allows is that all this discovery that we obtain can be used by all of the plaintiffs, and so each plaintiff doesn't have to incur the cost and time to do it themselves.
Okay, maybe you could explain a little bit about the logic of what's involved here. You've got evidence that, or testimony from patients and doctors who are your clients saying that they were harmed by this drug, right?
Correct.
And presumably the drug companies are denying those claims. Now, what's the sort of overall philosophical theory according to which they're going to put data forward to refute your claims?
Their general defense, as always, as it always has been, is to attack the victim. So they want to gather all of the information, medical history, educational history, mental health history of each of the plaintiffs, so that they can argue that it wasn't the drug that caused the person's problems, it was their own history and their own personal problem.
Oh, I had forgotten about that for a second. I guess the discovery process goes both ways.
Oh, yeah.
And so they want to know everything about your clients to make the argument that they would have had these problems anyway, even if the symptoms are all apparently physiological, regardless of the history or height or weight or behavior or psychological tenor of the people taking it. If they all sort of cramp up and fold over in their stomach and say they have a pain in their stomach, they're going to argue that it's because of their own problems.
Right.
All right. Now, okay, so that's pretty much what's happened with the case. Now, there have been some developments outside the case that have been very relevant, it seems to me, to this, and that's what I want to talk about next. About 3 weeks ago, the Food and Drug Administration issued this kind of weird talking paper saying that there was more to worry about in terms of suicide among teens and young people who were taking SSRIs. Was it just Paxil or SSRIs in general?
all SSRIs, and also very significant to the talk paper was the fact that it was not only adolescents and children, but also adults.
Okay, so they issued this statement saying that it's that people should pay more, doctors and family members, and presumably the patients themselves should pay more attention to suicide problems in the administration of these drugs. And then they sort of vaguely suggested, it seemed to me, that the drug companies making these increase the warnings on their labels. And I've been trying to I've been trying to get a statement out of the FDA since then to find out how strong and under what legislative authority they were making these suggestions or orders or whatever. I haven't gotten anything from them yet. I'm going to continue to find out what I can. I also went after all the SSRI manufacturers. They provided a convenient list. And of the ones that I've contacted, only Lilly, who makes Prozac, has responded. And they responded in a completely off-to-the-side way, saying, we understand this, we understand that. I said, are you going to follow the suggestion and make a stronger warning? And they said, we understand this and we understand that. But they didn't say anything about it. It was a nice typeface, too, but it was irrelevant. And well, so I'm going to continue to work on that. What's going on with this FDA so-called sort of pseudo-warning?
Well, breaking through all the bureaucracy,
right?
What you do have in effect is the FDA now saying that the drug company should warn about a possible association between these drugs, the antidepressants, and suicide. The FDA, the reason that they haven't said you have to warn about this is simply that because they don't have the authority to do that.
Oh, okay.
The drug companies then respond whether they're going to warn or not, and then it's up to the FDA. If they said no, for example, the FDA would then potentially have to go into litigation to use other procedures to try to enforce that warning.
Now, this is the same FDA that's telling people they shouldn't buy drugs that are less expensive from Canada because they're unsafe. Do they have any credibility? Well, let's start with you. You can speak for yourself. Is the current FDA, which isn't the FDA of David Kessler by any means, speaking for the government, the drug companies, the patients? Who's it supposed to be speaking for? What do you think about all that?
Well, unfortunately, they are not. Their interests are not aligned with what's best for the consumers, and I think that's becoming very apparent in the exposure that we're starting to see of the underlying problems. And it's not just the FDA, it's the regulators in Canada, it's the regulators in the UK. You now have activity going on in all of those areas that is investigating whether the drug companies are far too influential over the regulators, making it so that the regulators are ineffective in what their duties are.
Now, in fact, there was a direct intervention of the FDA in your Paxil addiction case, in which they argued that because they had approved these drugs for sale, no other jurisdiction could, the courts could not say anything about whether they were any good.
Well, that's correct. The FDA has intervened on both the suicide issue and on the advertising issue related to whether GlaxoSmithKline can represent Paxil as non-habit forming, and that has come out of the office of Dan Troy, who's the current chief counsel for the FDA. It appears to be consistent with his agenda, which is absolutely the same as the drug companies, given that he, prior to being in the regulatory offices, used to work for the drug companies, representing them on their claims against the FDA.
So this is Fox's running the chicken coopocracy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it's unbelievable when you see the connections there. In fact, the intervention of the FDA with their amicus brief, which came in, again, against the consumer in favor of the drug companies, arguing that even if the drug company wanted to warn about suicide, the FDA would not let them. And that was a result of a phone call by Pfizer's lead counsel, Malcolm Wheeler, to Dan Troy saying, hey, I need some help in this litigation. Will you file an amicus brief? And then suddenly we have an intervention by the FDA, which had not happened in these cases before. Following up on that, though, we asked at the FDA hearing that they had the advisory committee last February, we asked those at the FDA, Bob Temple, Thomas Loughran, those doctors who work with the SSRIs, how they feel about, you know, here they're now looking on whether they should warn about suicide, and we asked, how do you feel about Dan Troy coming in on your behalf and arguing against a suicide warning? And Dr. Temple's response to me when I asked was, I wouldn't touch that in a million years.
No, I don't want to get too far afield, but didn't the same administration promise a drug benefit under Medicare that would cost $400 billion, and an actuary there figured it would cost $500 billion, and they threatened to fire him if he told the truth? Is that kind of the same? It sounds like the same pattern to me.
Yeah, well, we're looking at, actually, we had the exact same problem with the advisory committee hearing last February that the congressional committees are now investigating.
Right, we're going to get to that in a second. And in fact, it's no accident probably that this particular case over there with Medicare and the $100 billion differential had to do with money that was going to go to the drug companies.
Absolutely.
So it's drug companyocracy is what it's starting to look like.
It's no secret that the power the drug companies have in Washington.
Is that because they give more contributions than others, or they give free drugs to the people and they put them into a state of mental anguish that lets them manipulate them?
I think it's the intense influence they have both over in their lobbying efforts as well as over the regulators and the medical profession generally. I mean, they've really proliferated the entire industry in every nook and cranny.
And maybe if they've addicted 10 million people to drugs, those people are eager to see that things happen the way the drug companies tell them to. Or is that a little too paranoid?
Well, I don't know that it's too paranoid. I do think that you see a lot of people who don't want to accept the ugly picture that these drugs are not efficacious.
Right.
I mean, every time you still have, you know, people saying, well, you can't deny that these drugs have helped, you know, millions of people deal with their depression. And when you look at the studies and you show, but wait, even the FDA recognizes that the efficacy or the effectiveness of these drugs is marginal, if at all.
So in fact, the sole redeeming aspect of this whole argument is they help people live better lives, know themselves, be undepressed, and so on. And you're saying that there's a lot of evidence to show that isn't true.
Not only is that not true, that was just an extremely successful marketing campaign.
Oh, I'm shocked to hear that a marketing campaign.
Yeah, well, the documents that we've seen, the internal documents show that even the diseases and the disorders that are marketed out there to the doctors came out of the marketing department's not research and development.
Well, I was watching an ad last night, in preparation for this interview, for social anxiety disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these more nervous, frantic people than I've ever seen in real life anywhere, sitting around at a party with little name tags that said fearful and whatnot. And then after they take the I think it's Paxil sustained release, they take off their little fearful name tags and say Mary and Fred and so on, and they're happy, and they start mingling.
Right,
and it's even more insidious than that cute little blob that floats around for Zoloft. Yes.
Well, you know, when you look at the fundamental problem is that, you know, they're coming up with a cure for every ill, and the reality is these are not medical treatments; they're not scientifically proved, and unfortunately, you know, when you look at the symptoms, pretty much everybody could at some time in their life fit into what they're considered diseased people.
Right. So they diseasify the entire life cycle and every aspect of it, and then say, here's a cure for it.
You got it.
Okay. Will the drug companies comply with the vague suggestion of the FDA that they increase the warnings on their drugs, do you think?
I think they will in a watered-down version, especially because they're getting quite a bit of pressure. But like I said, the way that they can effectively really water down the warning about a significant, you know, potentially fatal risk,
right,
is again by going back to blaming the disease. And you see the FDA even doing this in their talk paper. They talk about there may be an association with these drugs causing the suicide and hostility, but don't forget, depression is a very serious illness and disease, and it shouldn't be taken lightly. And what they're trying to give the picture to the medical profession and the public is still, again, these drugs alone can cause people to become violent and suicidal. They're not going to admit that. They, these are people who have no mental health history at all. Healthy volunteers have had the same reaction. So unfortunately, I don't think they're going to effectively warn the medical profession and the public that in fact these drugs alone can cause this, no matter what the person was prescribed the medication for.
Presumably, it ought to be possible to do a straightforward test where you take X number of depressed people and give half of them SSRIs and half of them no SSRIs and see, I mean, a large enough sample, and see how many become suicidal, how many become violently aggressive, and so on. On top of which, if you give healthy whatever that means, healthy volunteers, the same drugs, and you know, a higher percentage than normal start becoming suicidal and aggressively violent, you'd have a pretty straightforward amount of data there, wouldn't you?
Well, we do have evidence of that.
That
has been done. It's interesting because it hasn't been done on the grand scale necessary to establish what they call, you know, the statistically causal link.
Right.
They always say, is there an association? But epidemiology studies as well as healthy volunteer studies have shown the same evidence that the depressive disorder studies have shown, that in some people, it looks like 3 to 5% of the population will suffer the drug-induced suicidality and hostility.
And in fact, what you vis-a-vis what you just said about watering down, I've watched these Paxil commercials pretty closely now, and at the end, they say, and they practically whisper, that going off the drug may cause some side effects.
Correct.
But they don't say suicidality. They don't say aggressive behavior. They don't say withdrawal symptoms.
They
just say some side effects.
Right.
Okay. Why don't, if we can, I don't know how much you've gotten into this in your own work in this, but could we say a little bit about the physiology, biochemistry of all this, and why should it be that a drug that regulates, modulates, and completely changes the flow of serotonin up and down through the neurons, should, in addition to those other effects that are supposedly the good ones that are trying to be achieved, also make people aggressively violent or suicidal? There is some kind of logical consistency there, though, isn't there, that something that's moderating the most intimate chemical functions that give us our identity and our behavior and especially our mood, that's what they are, should alter mood in such a way that it also makes people suicidal or very aggressive?
Yes. Well, they haven't figured out. There's a lot of things. That's why I was saying scientifically. They haven't scientifically figured out really the ramifications of affecting the serotonin, but it does alter your brain chemistry. They've marketed that, you know, depression is caused by an imbalance, a chemical imbalance, but there's nothing that's proved that, and they certainly don't know what is in balance. So that's one of the primary faults of these drugs and why we've, you know, been able to show time and again that they have not been able to prove that these drugs actually do help.
Because I've been thinking about it a little bit, and obviously the ecology of mind, the ebb and flow of these chemicals in the human brain is something that's evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, and if you throw in our primate ancestors, millions of years, and over 10 years, some scientists and marketing people have taken upon themselves to manipulate the ups and downs of these chemicals that so intimately regulate how we feel about things. It would seem like they're bound to be untoward effects, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the most significant things that are coming out right now is what people are referring to as the dosage issue.
Right.
There's evidence being revealed in the UK that these drug companies have known for over a decade that the dosage, an increase in the dosage, does not increase the benefits of the medication, but it does increase the side effects. So what you have are people who come in, they might be having a bad reaction to the medication, maybe the suicidality, the hostility. Their doctor says, oh, you must not be getting enough. So they increase the dose. Well, that makes the side effects worse when they actually believe that it's going to help them more. And so it's a huge issue of fraud by the companies on dosage.
Okay, but this is really like, I mean, if it weren't serious, it would be funny. If you think of it in terms of computers, for example, because it's in some sense that level of technological sophistication, you've got this huge, powerful computer that's running the whole, that's running your body and mind, essentially, and you've got somebody coming in and mucking around and pulling out a board here and a wire there to say, oh, does that feel better now?
You got it. It really is. That's what makes it so unscientific, is that the doctors will say, well, let's try this drug, and
right.
They come back, and I'm having trouble with it. Well, why don't you try this one, too, or
right.
Let's increase the dose. It's like guinea pig.
Right. All right. So will whatever is decided by the drug companies to put a warning or more of a warning on their drugs have any impact on your case, or will they argue the way the tobacco companies, I think, now argue that, well, we've got a warning on the cigarette pack, so therefore, if you get lung cancer, that's your problem.
Right. They might try to sever the liability in that regard, but I don't think that they'll ever be willing to put a strong enough warning on that would actually effectively do that, because they want to continue that misinformation campaign One, that the drugs are effective. Two, that they're safe. And three, most importantly, that the illnesses are so bad that if we don't give these people these drugs, then they're going to be killing themselves anyway.
It's a behavior. It's a step of last resort to give these drugs, right?
Well, it's funny because, you know, they make it sound like that, but in reality, it's not being prescribed that way at all, and it's not marketed that way. They market it that, you know, these drugs can be effective for everything. You know,
right.
it's safe. You could give it to somebody like you would aspirin.
Right. It's a lot of a be all you can be mentality. Also, that seems to be argued.
Yeah. Don't. Why suffer through? You know, if you have a sad thing in your life, why suffer through that? Just take this medication. You'll be just the life of the party.
One last analogy here. I was listening to something on the BBC that was pretty scary about Monsanto and Roundup, and how they developed these chemicals, and they were essentially addicting the farmers all over the world to their seeds and their their pesticides. They were making billions of dollars, and they were controlling the regulators. It seemed very similar to me. If you analogize to the brain, to the field, and Monsanto to GlaxoSmithKline, and the addictive nature of the chemicals that they're using, and especially the fact that they represent the latest, best, or most complicated scientific understanding of how nature works, and how to regulate gene expression, and how to regulate a serotonin expression, and it's being done by huge multinational conglomerates making billions of dollars, running roughshod over governments, and doing all kinds of damage to the environment and people's brains that no one can seem to stop.
Oh, and the drug companies know very well what they need to control to be able to affect their benefits, the money that they make. And you know, you start with the regulators.
Right.
You know, and you can't, you know, we all have this perception that the FDA is this objective resource out there to protect us. But, you know, if you talk about a David and Goliath or the resources the FDA has itself to try to police the drug companies, it's not their role. They could never do it even if it were, but yet people have this impression that that's what their job is.
It's not just the regulators that are controlled, it's the scientists, isn't it?
Because
the brain scientists and the biochemists and the pesticide scientists are dependent for their careers on the money that comes from these drug and pesticide companies to do research and so on, isn't it?
Absolutely, and the scientists and their universities that they work under, I mean, there's very serious financial pressures there that affect their entire careers.
So an economist, or let alone an ethicist at a big university that's getting a lot of funding from these sources, is not going to be allowed to say, you know, they're poisoning the environment, they're poisoning people's brains, because they'll be fired because the university doesn't want them, because they'll lose the money, and then they'll be out of a job.
Exactly. Not only are they controlling what is said, if there's some negative things, they keep that out of the scientific literature. They're also very prolific in what they create as scientific literature. So what we're seeing being exposed again out more in the public that we've been seeing in litigation for years is the ghostwriting issue.
Right.
You've got all these drug companies writing up the scientific journal article in the study and then deciding after it's already been written who they should put as the author. And, you know, they have their selection of what they call opinion leaders that they've used in the past and have real nice relationships, like Dr. Mann, M-A-N-N, you'll see at Columbia. He's one of the people the FDA is supposedly using as an objective reviewer of the scientific data related to the kids and suicide. Anyway, they use one of these opinion leaders or a group of them to be the authors on a study that the people never even did or even saw the raw data of.
To do one more piece of physiological stuff, is the addiction that you're alleging is created by Paxil similar to or different from, or how does it differ from the addictions that are caused by heroin, nicotine, cocaine, or alcohol?
Well, it's withdrawal and dependence, and it's interesting because it fits within the same categories, but the levels of addiction or the scale of dependence is really what it's called. It varies. It's not just either is it addictive or not addictive.
Right.
Is it physically addictive or physiologically addictive? Is it mentally addictive? But we do have, you know, I have had a number of clients tell me that when they were trying to figure out what was wrong with them, they would go on the websites and put in search engine names for what they were, the symptoms they were suffering, and they would be getting help sites for people on trying to get off of heroin or alcohol.
Right.
So there are, you know, you do certainly do see some similarities.
Do you have scientists working for you who've tried to figure out whether or not the use of serotonin boosters eventually atrophies the serotonin production capacity of the brain so that people lack it when they don't get it from the boosters, and then they're in a deficiency state, and then they get all these symptoms?
Well, actually, what I have are scientists who are trying to look at the, then they're not working for us, but they've contacted me to make me aware of what their studies are showing, and that is that this depletion, that you end up, ultimately, if you've been taking the drug for a long period of time, it seriously alters what serotonin is in your body.
Right.
And that's why you oftentimes will hear people say, well, after a year or so, it just, quote-unquote, stopped working.
Right. The drug stopped working.
The drug stopped working. And so, you know, whether it's considered a buildup or a tolerance to the medication or a permanent effect on what their serotonin levels are and how you can get that back, there's different theories, you know, certain diet theories or vitamins and things like that to try to get that back. But, you know, the long-term negative effects of altering somebody's serotonin levels we're only just now seeing.
GlaxoSmithKline and SmithKline Beecham. Who's on first? Who owns who? Maybe we keep coming back to this because I keep getting confused about it. Who owns whom and who's being sued here?
Well, think of it as just corporate structures. There was Glaxo Wellcome.
Right.
And there was SmithKline Beecham. They merged as a corporation.
Right.
So they are, their corporate name now is SmithKline Beecham doing business as GlaxoSmithKline.
Oh, so SmithKline Beecham sort of bought a GlaxoWellcome.
Correct.
And created the doing business as entity of GlaxoSmithKline.
Correct. So now, as far as the litigation is concerned, they're basically one and the same, but they've just got a varying corporate structure.
Who's going to write the check?
SmithKline Beecham.
Okay.
They're one and the same.
They're one and the same. Okay. another level of activity here. Congressman, and I know this from a press release that I got from your office yesterday, which I investigated myself to find out what was going on. Congressman John Barton, a Republican who heads the House Energy Committee, which has jurisdiction over the FDA, sent them a letter, which was a model of discovery, it seemed to me, in which he asks for every scrap of paper, thought, meeting, computer record, or whatever they've ever had having to do with SSRIs, and they want it sent over there to the Energy Committee. What's the importance of this, and how does it fit in with your case?
To me, this is right now the most important thing that's happening, because this might be finally enough, what's the significant pressure may be able to come from Congress to actually break through that cozy connection between the FDA and the drug companies. Both Representatives Barton and Greenwood, they're doing their own congressional investigation. There's another investigation being done by Senator Grassley,
right,
who's also investigating the FDA and whether they withheld information or squashed information within their own organization and refused to allow that to come out to the advisory committee in February. So when you start having congressional investigations going forward, that might be finally, like I said, the pressure that's necessary to actually have an effect over the influence of the drug companies on the FDA.
Now, are you going to get, which is apparently here, the even bigger issue than the addictive effects of Paxil, isn't it? I mean, it's the control of the drug companies over the FDA make possible all of these other abuses.
Well, and it affects the whole picture is really the mental health industry.
Right. Right, especially with its emphasis on giving people pills.
Yeah.
Will you be given access to the data that the House Energy Committee has subpoenaed, or I don't know if they subpoenaed, they asked for it right now.
They haven't subpoenaed it yet. We're actually trying to work as best we can to provide them the information we have, because remember I had mentioned that we have information that the FDA has never seen either.
Right. No. Are you working with the House Energy Committee to tell them where to look?
Yes.
Okay, and in exchange for that input from you, are they going to give you access to the data that they get?
No, we actually get access to stuff just the same as the public would.
Well, will the public get access to all the data that they're requesting from the FDA?
I certainly hope so. I don't know if that will happen unless and until there's an actual hearing.
Oh, but as of now, they're just asking for it, and they'll get it, and their staff will get to look at it, but the public won't get to look at it?
As far as I understand.
And for the public, would you like to be able to see it?
Yeah, you know, I'm curious on what they might have that we don't already have. Like I said, I'm trying to get to them the stuff that even the FDA may not be able to get to them, but I'm under, you know, court orders that don't permit me to release a lot of the internal documents, obviously.
Even to the Congress.
Oh yeah, no, it's
unless the Congress subpoenaed it, of course.
Congress could theoretically subpoena it from the court. That's true.
Right. And so what do you expect is going to happen with that? Do you think the FDA is going to comply, or there's going to be a big struggle between the FDA and Congress, and they're going to say executive privilege or something?
Well, I don't. I think that the FDA is going to do their best to comply. I think that the congressional committees are doing a good job at being very targeted, very specific in what they're targeting.
Right.
And what my fear is, because they're also asking for information from the drug companies as well, and so just all my fear is that, you know, as bureaucracies can be, that they don't get paper stormed too badly.
Right.
You know, we've been doing this for 12 years, and it's taken us that long to really siphon out, you know, roomfuls of documents to really see the clear picture.
That being that the two approaches of stifling inquiry are, one is to refuse to give anything, and the other one is to give every piece of paper you've got.
You got
so
it.
That you can't figure out what's going on.
And that's an extremely effective defense, and you know, I mean, that's the whole thing with Congress, is will they have the time to ferret out the stuff? Do they know what they're looking at? I think they're going to really need to call in on some experts in the field, some of the scientists who have been willing to stand up against the drug companies on these issues, to get an actual education of it, because it can get pretty complicated.
How do you account for the fact that there's a apparently courageous Republican who's taking this stand and doing this in the face of the usual onslaught of countervailing forces?
Well, I think that two reasons on that, and it's actually interesting because all three of them are Republicans.
Right.
But I think the reason for that is that the problems with the FDA go far beyond just the current administration. I'll agree that Dan Troy's actions were as egregious as they came, and I think that was a direct result of the current administration, and that, like I was saying, is when they came in and intervened in a lawsuit.
Right.
But the problems with the FDA and with the SSRIs has gone on for over 12 years now.
Across the Clinton and Bush administrations.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, hopefully even a bipartisan approach, really what they need to do is expose the problems in the FDA, ferret those out, restructure it so it does become effective for its purposes.
Well, that would be something.
Be a colossal effort, but it's certainly necessary, especially if we all want to be able to continue to trust the FDA.
Would you accept an administrative position at the FDA in next administration?
I don't think they'd ever offer it to me.
Okay. What's going on in the UK? Is it similar, different, worse? What's the case there?
Oh, it's actually paralleling quite interestingly. The UK has had, when the regulators, they have their own problems, although to their credit, they were the first to actually be willing to raise a suicide risk issue with the drug companies back last summer. As a result of that, though, we're now seeing that the individual, Richard Brooke, is the person that they had designated to put on the panel as the quote-unquote consumer advocate.
Right.
So that panel, the MHRA panel reviewing these issues, could say, well, we've heard from this person too, and it makes them look more objective. The problem with that is that a couple weeks ago, Richard Brooke resigned,
right.
And the reason he resigned, as he stated, was because he said, last week I resigned from the government's watchdog on antidepressants after it tried to cover up its own 10-year failure to identify the serious side effects of the drug Paxil.
Well, it sounds like what's going on in the U.S., it sounds like a Richard Clark without stretching it too far.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, we finally have some people who are willing to step up and say, you know, I tried to alert these people within the lines that I was supposed to of the problems. They didn't listen to me, and now I have no other choice but to go public with it. And that's exactly what Richard Brooke is doing.
Well, a student of comparative government would see that it's a global problem then. If it's almost identical in its structure in the UK to the US, that it's bigger than any one country. It's the drug companies controlling the regulators, controlling the use of the drugs.
Absolutely.
Is there any government research going on or private research to find a cure for the SSRI addiction that you're litigating in your case?
No, I think right now what I do know of is some research that's taking place to determine really what is the actual problem. It has purposefully not been studied thoroughly to see how many people are going to suffer from the withdrawal issues, although it looks to be like a huge number, high percentages up in 60, 70, even up to 80% of the people in the data that we've seen.
60 to 70% of the people who take the drug end up becoming addicted to it?
Will have problems with coming off the drug, yes.
Are most of the people who have ever taken the drug still taking it? But you see where I'm going with
there's
that.
There's quite a bit of people that are still taking it, and there's a lot of people that are still taking it simply because they can't stop, even though they
want to
stop.
Yes, well, that's what I meant. If it's an addictive drug, but a lot of people are still taking it, then the withdrawal symptoms haven't hit them yet. But if they ever, if it's discovered, for example, that it has long-term bad effects, like it depletes your serotonin your capacity to produce serotonin, they're going to be stuck, aren't they?
Well, and even scarier is the effect it has on mothers who are breastfeeding and women who are pregnant. There's very serious concerns, and we're starting to see studies showing that kids are being born with their own withdrawal symptoms.
So it's like crack babies. It's like Paxil babies is what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since I think it was you who told me, I've been watching, and when I was visiting all of the SSRI manufacturers' sites to try to contact them, I noticed that women in their 30s seem to be in all of the pictures of people who are most especially be happy after they take these drugs, and also on the television commercials.
Well, that's their target audience. That's the demographic that they are targeting in the promotions, the mid-30s to mid-40s women.
Right.
They advertise in the women's magazines, on the women's television shows. That has been to the OBGYN doctors. It's very clear that that's one of their primary targets for promoting the drug.
Okay. In the work that you do, how much of it is spent formulating legal arguments versus how much you have to spend dealing with the logistics of handling all the data you're getting and in handling all the plaintiffs that you're managing?
We keep a lot of people really busy, and what's interesting is part of our approach has always been not just fighting in the courts and in litigation, but trying to work with the media, such as yourself, to increase the awareness of the problems. When we've seen what we've seen, we feel like we have a civic duty to make sure that some of this fraud is exposed so that the public doesn't continue to be harmed.
How's your budget for public relations versus the drug company's budget for public relations?
Well, you know, it's funny because the public relations that we do is just trying to get, you know, people aware, and I guess to an extent it would help to bring in more cases, but there's oftentimes people that we work with, the public relations, and we don't represent them or anything. We're just trying to get the word out.
Okay. My last analogy from another field here comes when I was thinking about Iraq and the idea of collateral damage.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that I'm wondering whether, as far as you can tell, the drug companies and the FDA consider suicidality, addiction, withdrawal symptoms, and the other drawbacks of SSRIs to be simply collateral damage. That's the inevitable price to be paid for some of the huge benefits they claim accrue to people who take them.
If you could establish clear effectiveness of these medications, you might have an issue there. But the reality is, and the studies are showing time and again, that it's a placebo effect or no effect at all.
So, in fact, it's not collateral damage, but it's kind of recreational damage or core damage rather than being on the side of something that's actually doing some good.
Right. Well, and I think that, you know, we've all been convinced over the last 10 years I think it's one of the most successful marketing campaigns we've ever seen. That is that, you know, these drugs can help all ails, that they actually do help, and when in reality they have very little efficacy.
Well, in fact, what comes to mind then is this guy standing in the back of this wagon selling snake oil.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Or those pills that were very popular, Lydia Pinkham's potion, which turned out to be alcohol, 70% alcohol.
Yeah, unfortunately, we find that billions of dollars spent later by insurance companies and Medi-Cal and individuals. But you know, I think given time, over time, people start to realize what the problems are, and like I said, the congressional pressure here will hopefully help to expose, the bill of goods we've been sold for so long.
Okay. There was an op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times about Paxil and similar drugs, saying that these drugs are transforming humans into something new and different and not quite human. Did you read it? Have you any thoughts about it? He was essentially saying that instead of humans being turned into cyborgs with mechanical appendages, they're being turned into sort of post-human humans by the massive use of SSRIs. Is there anything to that?
Oh, absolutely. And the experts talk about it as emotional blunting. It really does affect people's ability to go through good and bad things in their life. And oftentimes I have people describing to me that, you know, okay, so they feel better. They don't feel as sad as they did because they're now under a psychotropic medication. But they also don't have the good feelings that they would have, too. They don't get excited when their kid hits a home run. They just sort of feel flat.
Hmm. And in fact, if some of I don't want to get too political, but if some of their problems are based on the structure of the society and the economic relationships and so on, and if the drugs make them make that irrelevant to them, they're not going to be doing anything to change those things, are they?
No, and you can't look past that. It is that personal responsibility issue, and they've promoted these drugs in a way to relieve people of the personal responsibility that they have, and the difficulties that we face on a daily life. You know, they've said, well, that it's not you, it's not your life, it's a disease.
Right.
But the reality is, no, it is. It's stuff that, you know, life is tough these days, and there's a lot to deal with.
So in fact, this is exactly 180 degrees opposite to personal responsibility.
It is.
Which is so much the rallying cry of people when they say, well, we can't give people welfare, and we can't give public education, and we can't do that, and we can't help people out economically because it's their own personal responsibility. The drug company's arguments are implicitly the opposite of that.
Absolutely, unless you sue them. Once you sue them, suddenly Right. Everything is your fault.
Well, how convenient. Could you rattle off some statistics about how many people are now taking SSRIs, how many children, and how much money is accruing to the drug companies as a result?
You know,
you don't have those figures right at your
fingertips. We were talking with some people about it.
Right.
10 million or something kids.
Right, 10 million kids is the figure that's being... Now, I thought these drugs weren't even approved for use in children.
They're not indicated for use in children except for Prozac, that's true.
So is this all, quote, off-label, end quote,
is.
Stuff?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's an interesting side story on that because off-label use by the medical doctors is just commonplace at this point. The drug companies are totally aware of that. What I think their incentive of getting an indication for the kids' usage is it allows them to promote it even stronger for kids in their advertising and in their promotions to doctors. But apart from that, they're very well aware that the doctors are using it for kids all the time. And one of the reasons they're doing that is because the doctors have been given the misinformation that, one, the drugs are effective, and, two, that they're safe.
Right.
If they knew that the drugs, one, are not effective, and, two, can cause kids or people to kill themselves, I don't think you'd see so much off-label use. But the drug companies have done nothing to warn the doctors about that.
Okay, now, beyond off-label are the emails that I'm constantly getting offering to sell me SSRIs without a prescription. and now I've asked the FDA to comment on this. They haven't. I'm wondering whether the drug companies don't care whether the drugs are sold not just off-label but without prescriptions because they get money for selling them without prescriptions either. Is there a whole other story going on there?
It seems like there must be. It's one that I'm not aware of, but, you know, just my association with these drugs, I get those. I must get at least 10 a day. And obviously,
right.
that along with the
you must get 10 offers to buy them to sell them to you without a prescription.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
it's just not a fluke.
Oh no, it's designed. You know, people who do any kind of search or have any kind of connection at all, they figure that out and they send out those. And I don't know who those people are. I don't know if they're backed by the drug companies or not.
Right. Well, but they must be getting the drugs from somewhere.
Yeah.
Assuming that they're real.
Yeah.
Given all of the stuff that we've just gone over and stuff that we probably haven't, shouldn't your case be a slam dunk?
No case against a drug company is a slam dunk.
Okay.
Simply because they have very serious resources that they can put at this. I've also got to deal with, like I said, the public's misperception for so many years that these drugs are helpful to people. So the most common mistake that people say is, well, wouldn't that person have killed themselves anyway? Weren't they really depressed, and doesn't depression cause suicide? No, no, and no. There's been nothing scientific to establish that at all. But that's what has been promoted in the public and in the medical profession, so I have to break through that socialized belief.
All right. Let me just try to put something on the table here that through this interview that I'd like to see discussed more. Anything you want to say about it is okay. When I was an undergraduate, I had a friend who was a pre-med student, and he spent a lot of time drawing pictures on napkins of serotonin and of LSD and said how and pointing out to everyone how similar they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been my feeling for a while here that LSD works by blocking the reuptake of serotonin in the brain,
right,
which is how Paxil and Zoloft and Effexor work.
Right.
And I've often been curious, and I've never seen anything yet done about this, to find out on the social level, why LSD became a black market, subversive, dangerous, banned, contraband substance, whereas Paxil is, making the pain for the mortgages of lots of, or the payments for the house of lots of drug executives, and why that difference has been implemented in the socio-political marketing structure of the country.
Now we go right back to the effect of lobbying and what's illegal and what's not.
And who makes money out of stuff? I mean, a few people made money out of LSD, but it wasn't the kind of blockbuster drug. I mean, it was the blockbuster drug of its time.
Of its time.
What?
Of its time, until people realize what it is, you know, for what it's worth, and then we're seeing the same thing happen now. And I think, you know, who knows, 10 years from now, we might look back on the SSRI age and realize, wow, you know, that was really effective marketing, but that was a very dangerous drug and not that far different from illegal substances.
People would say, what a trip.
Yeah, exactly.
We're just about finished. There was a discussion, another one that I heard, about Afghanistan, referring to it as a narco state run by narco terrorists. Is there a chance that if this kind of tendency that we've been talking about, if the drug companies control the regulators and the government, that we could move to being on the brink of being a pharma state of some kind, where in fact it's the drug dealers who control the government and the society?
Well, I think we already are more than anybody wants to admit. When you take a look, I just saw an article today about how many people are taking medications, psychotropic medications, today versus, you know, 15 years ago. And that was one of the promotional campaigns that they were creating back in the late 80s. If you remember, in the late 80s, it was, you know, just say no to drugs.
Yes.
And you know, we're talking about psychotropic drugs. Then we see in the internal documents from the PR department saying, well, let's see, what can we do to socialize people to be okay with the idea of taking a psychotropic medication,
right,
and taking one every day?
Right.
Now we are, you know, fast forward 15 years later, now it's commonplace. Nobody has any problem with somebody, oh, you're on Paxil, you're on Zoloft, yeah, me too, my mom is, my brother is, whatever.
Right, so it's been socialized. So in fact, what LSD used to do, of people saying, oh, wow, I see the nature of reality, I see the false nature of the political system, I'm going to go join the movement. Now people take Paxil and say, oh, well, my social anxiety disorder is over, let's go have another drink or something.
Yeah.
It's the social context or the social impetus of the drug that has made one was a disruptive technology, and the other is an assimilative technology, if I can make that word up, I guess. And there are more powerful social, political, economic forces working to the generation of a state where everyone's taking those drugs. Or the closest literary analogy, of course, is Soma in Brave New World.
Right.
But of course, that, and I guess it was addictive, and I guess it was a drug that made everyone accept the society that they lived in as the automatons that they were, and they just carried on that way. So, but why is it that people are not willing? And even that person who wrote the Times article yesterday, the op-ed piece, at the end, he says, "Yeah, maybe we're better off this way."
Except for we don't know what the long-term effects of taking these medications are, and we're starting to see very serious, scary results.
Well, and the last news I heard was all about the essential bankruptcy of the Social Security and Medicare system, and the trillions and trillions of dollars in debt that are never going to be paid back, and so on, and that the society is going to be pretty much collapsing in terms of its economic situation in the coming years. That would seem like an economic anxiety syndrome is something that people will have that could presumably be treated with Paxil as well.
Well, but think about all the money that's been paid out by those institutions for a drug that's not effective.
Well, then we're left with only one last hope, and that's your case, isn't it? All right, so we'll keep following to see if you can save the day for humanity and civilization.
I think it's just the bitter pill, so to speak, to swallow, that you cannot trust the FDA as much as you think you can, and you certainly can't trust your doctors to think that they know really the ramifications of what they're giving you, because they're not being told by the drug companies, and that's where the drug companies are so talented and successful in their promoting these medications, and it's making them sound way more beneficial than they are without telling about the very serious side effects.
Okay, well, people who listen to the Utopia Medical News Network will get the truth. What happens next with the case?
Well, we continue forward. We'll see. I think one of the biggest things is to see, you know, what's exposed by Congress, if anything, and obviously that will be used in our litigation to try to further establish the problems related to these drugs and the harm they've caused.
Okay. Well, good. You've caused good here by talking to us. I want to thank you for it and tell you that you're welcome anytime on Utopia Medical News Network, and we'll talk to you again soon and see what happens.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.